I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up on the story, One Woman's Memories, covering the return of Nelson Mandela and the end of apartheid. Audrey Brown was born in Cliptown, just outside Soweto. It was one of the first places where Mandela went after he was released from prison on Robben Island. Everyone wanted to shake his hand, and Audrey was there too.
Then, of course, it was revealed that my grandfather and my grandmother. And he's, how is Vesta? This is my grandmother. How is she? And, you know, a little chat about that. And then, of course, there are billions of people trying to get to talk to him. So the next time you see him, you think he might have forgotten all about that, but actually he hadn't.
Like so many other South Africans, Audrey Brown was swept up in the admiration for Mandela as he steered the country away from apartheid and toward its first democratic election in 1994. I'll talk with her about her memories and the difference that Mandela made after the news. Audrey Brown has worked most of her life as a reporter with South African newspapers and with the BBC. Before that, though, she was raised in the thick of South Africa's armed struggle, the fight against apartheid. But all the time that she was growing up, the man everyone talked about was just a mystery. She'd never seen Nelson Mandela. Like so many others, she saw him in February 1990, when he emerged into the South African summer sunlight after serving 27 years in prison.
I was surprised at how sophisticated he was, how refined and how elegant. Everything about him was so new. You know, he was so unexpected, even though we didn't know much about him and didn't have anything to peg him on. But he was still just this entity that was so intact and so complete. It seemed like everything that we had hoped he would be, everything that we yearned for a leader like Nelson Mandela to be, he was all those things and a whole range of other things more that we hadn't even begun to think about.
In a few short years, Mandela was South Africa's president, helping steer the country toward democracy. More than that, though, he taught so many of the rest of us the meaning of the word dignity. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I used to be a reporter, and if you ask any reporter about the one event that they'll never forget covering, they'll have a story to tell you. Mine's about covering the South African election in 1994. More specifically, it's about the Wednesday morning, April 27th, when I was taken on a bus to a tiny village called Inanda in KwaZulu-Natal province. We had to board that bus at some hour like 4 in the morning, so it was still dark when we got there. And the grass where we sat in front of the small Oklangi schoolhouse was still wet with dew. But no one complained. We were there to watch Nelson Mandela cast his ballot in South Africa's first democratic election.
It was just past dawn when Nelson Mandela stepped purposefully up the chipped concrete steps of an old schoolhouse. From the half shadows of the front porch, he looked out over the dark green in the morning mist shrouding Bambayi, a settlement that has suffered more than its share of violence. Mandela then brought one of his folded ballots outside, held it over a ballot box, paused, smiled, and dropped it inside.
We sincerely hope that by the mere casting of a vote, the result will give hope to all South Africans and will make us, all South Africans, realize that this is our country. We are one nation.
Audrey Brown is a BBC journalist with deep roots in South Africa and in the struggle against apartheid. Her own parents' home and her own university room were at one time safe houses for ANC activists. Audrey would grow up to see Nelson Mandela transform her country and change the lives of all her friends and family. Her first memory of that fight for democracy was June 16th, 1976. Today it's remembered as the Soweto Uprising, the beginning of a time when blacks across South Africa began to refuse to live as second-class people. At the time, it was simply known as the day when 175 people, many of them children, were shot.
And I remember my uncle picking me up, and we were scrambling up a ladder to get onto the roof of my grandfather's house so that we could see what was happening in Soweto, because there were massive roadblocks that stopped us from going into the sections where, you know, the clashes were happening. So we stood on my grandfather's roof and looked across, and from Cliptown to Soweto, so you sort of face in a westerly direction, and it was winter, and it was very cold and sort of misty, and the smoke from all the fires coming, you know, that people had lit in the late afternoon to prepare for the evening. And I just remember feeling that ice cold, and this feeling of the tear gas sort of settling on your face and stinging your eyes and making your skin itch.
And you would have been, what, about 8 years old at the time, Audrey?
Around about 8, 9, yeah. But my father's friends as well, and they used to have lots of conversations. A lot of my father's friends also were people who were involved in struggle and were pursued by the police, for instance, and would often need to go into hiding. I remember our house often was, you know, safe haven for people's, for banned literature, for instance. Just the other day on Facebook, I was making friends with a writer whose book I had first come across hidden in my mother's chest, you know, where we put all the bedding and the lovely smell of cinnamon and so on. Hidden underneath there were all these books that were just being hidden because the book had been banned, and the police were confiscating the book. So politics and the struggle against apartheid actually permeated my childhood.
And as you got a little older, you started taking part in these street protests. How old would you have been when you started doing that, or when you got arrested for the first time, for that matter?
The first time I was about 14, I think, and it was for organizing and attending a band meeting, I think, is what the police would have called it.
Why would they bother with a 14, 15-year-old schoolgirl? I'm not saying that you weren't troubled at the time. Maybe you were. But it would seem to me that, you know, there were so many people involved in the armed struggle. It's almost surprising to think back to a time in the 80s when they'd be arresting students in high school.
These were the people that were embarrassing the apartheid state, because the apartheid state was seen to be shooting at children.
Tell me what you recall of your arrest. Were you frightened?
The time that I was frightened was when I was alone, when we'd been at another meeting, and there was tear gas and everything. And this policeman wasn't dressed in police uniform or anything like that. He was wearing an overcoat. It was winter again. You know, he just came. He came from among the, you know, the uniformed police, and came straight for me and grabbed me by my arm and dragged me towards this police van, and, you know, threw me into the van. There were other people there, but I, for some reason, was the only girl there. And I was taken to this disgusting police cell. I mean, it was dark, it was stinking. And as we were waiting for the cell to be unlocked, this man said to me in a very, his tone, I can't, when I think about it now, I'm not sure whether it's, was menacing or warning, as in, you know, think very carefully about this, because he said to me, you know, you're very young, and if you keep doing this, you're going to keep ending up in places like these, and I can't guarantee that you're going to, it's not going to be nice for you. You know, that was sort of what he was saying. And there was a sense in which, because I was alone, I think, and this was before I started hearing the other people calling to find out who had been arrested, that I felt scared, you know, simply because there was something very clear and directed about his message. He was making, you know, he was making a point, and he was trying to communicate something to me.
I want to talk a little bit about the years leading up to Mandela's release. My recollection was that pretty well from the mid-1980s, everybody knew it was going to happen at some point. But I'm not sure what the perspective of people living in South Africa at the time was. What do you recall?
Oh, we all knew. It was just a matter of when. And there were always these stories going around. November, definitely. January, for sure. Absolutely. Definitely going to happen. So even, but I mean, when the release was announced, even though there'd been that, and you know, the expectation in a way, it was still an incredible thunderclap. You know, you'd think that we were prepared for it, but somehow no. I still remember the sense of just expectation and exaltation. We were just, I mean, there was just such immeasurable joy, just, you know, just thinking, what would he look like? What would he be like? What would we be like? You know, what's going to happen next? Isn't this just the most incredible thing?
Because nobody had seen him, right? I mean, you had no idea what he looked like after all those years in prison.
Yeah, and everybody had sort of anticipated what he could look like. So there were all these facsimiles of him, you know, drawings. And our newspaper had tried to sort of make an image of him as well, based on his sort of, you know, he was quite sort of sturdy-looking man when he went into jail. You know, sort of plumpish, round face.
Almost jowly, I remember the pictures.
Yeah. And he came out and he was this tall, very slim man, you know, totally different to what we imagined he would look like, I think.
What do you remember thinking as you looked at his face?
It's quite silly what I thought, actually, besides feeling all the fun and fantastic emotions that were going through my mind at the time. I thought to myself, he looks almost Oriental. You know, he looks Japanese, I thought, like a dark Japanese man.
I remember also watching the same television pictures and thinking to myself, it almost looks like the man has not stood in the sunshine for a long, long time.
I just remember how striking he looked with Winnie Mandela next to him, and how it almost felt, seemed like she was showing him how to conduct himself in the face of masses and masses of people singing and shouting, Amandla, power, you know. Because when he went into jail, that wasn't quite the language.
Audrey Brown met Nelson Mandela a couple of days later. It would be the beginning of a time for her when she reported on and learned to admire the character of the man. And I'll talk with her more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story.
Sikeleli Afrika, malupakanisu ponolwayo, nisawilitandazo yetu, kosi sikelela.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. On February 11th, 1990, Nelson Mandela was freed from prison. His release from Robben Island was broadcast live and watched by millions of people around the world. At the time, Audrey Brown was working for a newspaper in Johannesburg. She had some idea of making her way to Cape Town to see Mandela's first walk on the mainland, but she couldn't get there. She comforted herself by knowing that he'd be coming next to Soweto, near her home, and so she was waiting there with thousands of others.
And I just remember seeing him standing there, and sort of there was a television microphone, you know, with the big furry one, and he kept poking at this microphone and asking, like, "What is this?" And the cameraman, not quite clear that, you know, not quite sure where they should say to Mandela, "Stop fiddling with that thing." But him looking around at everything, looking at people, you know, like nodding his head and waving and, you know, shaking hands, and, you know, he was just so engaged with everybody, looking at people and sort of catching people's eye and, you know, it was almost seemed to me like he was looking and saying, oh, I recognize that person. I wonder who that is. Whose child is that? You know, is that so-and-so? It felt like that was what he was doing.
And Audrey, were you there as a reporter or just there as an interested bystander?
Well, nobody was a bystander. I was there as a very, very engaged and involved reporter.
And did you get close to him on that day?
Yeah, I did. I did. I went. I think I got swept up as everybody else did, and sort of shook his hand. And I don't think I made a fool of myself and tried to hug him. I'm short, and he's very tall. But also, he has a sense of sort of physical dignity that you don't breach. So he'll put out his hand and shake your hand and ask you your name, and you tell him, and he'll ask you where you're from, and then you tell him, and then he would say, do you know so-and-so? Because I told him I was from Cliptown, and he said, do you know the Lollins? And I said, yes, I lived opposite the Lollins. And he's, okay, how is Mrs. Lollin? I said, Mrs. Lollin is very, very well. And then he asked a few more questions, and of course was revealed that my grandfather and my grandmother. And he's, how is Vesta? This is my grandmother. How is she? And, a little chat about that. And then, of course, there are billions of people trying to get to talk to him. So the next time you see him, you think he might have forgotten all about that, but actually he hadn't, So then you sort of pick up the conversation again, And some interactions that I've had with him over the years that would always involve conversations about the people that he knew were associated with me, my grandparents, my neighbors, and so on.
Did anything about him surprise you?
I was surprised at how sophisticated he was, how refined and how elegant, and how everything about him was so new. He was so unexpected, even though we didn't know much about him and didn't have anything to peg him on, but he was still just this entity that was so intact and so complete. It seemed like everything that we had hoped he would be, everything that we yearned for a leader like Nelson Mandela to be, he was all those things and a whole range of other things more that we hadn't even begun to think about. I mean, where I saw the kind of nobility of his humbleness was when I was one of the curators for the Constitutional Court, and this was being built on the site of a series of jails, prisons, where black South Africans had been imprisoned for all kinds of transgressions against apartheid. So, for instance, women who dared to have relationships with men other than, men of their own color, or, transgressing the color line, as it were, or people who were in the city without the proper documents. These were all apartheid laws. So all these people were imprisoned there. So the decision was that this would be, out of these jails and the suffering of the people, we would create the highest court for South Africa, the defender of the rights of the people, the Constitutional Court. And on the day that it was ready to show people around, some people around, people were still working on the building. So there were, scores of workers on the site. So when Nelson Mandela came to the site, they saw, and they were sort of, some of them were quite far away from him, and they saw him. And he saw them, and he started walking towards where they were, and his bodyguard always had this problem that they had to make it possible for him to move with the people and for people to come to him. So he was walking towards these hundreds of workers, and they were waving at him and sort of, and he, with this expression on his face, was this absolute delight. All the dignitaries were kind of waiting, for him to come and take his seat and for proceedings to start. But his first instinct was to go and talk to the people who were building this site with their hard hats and their dirty boots and their dirty overalls. He went to shake hands with them. And there's a beautiful picture that was taken on that day. It's not mine, and I don't know where it is now, but where you see this absolute joy streaming out of his face and out of their faces, and hands waving. It was just the most beautiful moment for me, seeing that. And in the time that I sort of observed him as a journalist, you'd always see him do that. You'd always see him go to where, walking through the airport, the cleaning ladies, he would go to where they are. You know, they didn't have to come to, you know, and sort of shuffle past and be jostled by crowds of people. He would always find his way to them. And I love that quality very, very, very much in him, because not many leaders have it.
Audrey Brown works now as a journalist with the BBC in London. But in the early 90s, she was a reporter in Johannesburg covering the days when Nelson Mandela was released. You're listening to the story. It was to be 4 years before the country was ready for its democratic election. And there was still a lot of fighting, particularly in the townships.
There'd been an attack on this particular area, and the rows and rows of houses had been burned down. And when we got there, it was sort of mid-morning. And we started asking people what had happened, and they told us, you know, these people came and they, you know, killed these people, so many people, and so is still missing. And the men of that area had actually fled into the rushes. There was a river nearby. So as I was going with a photographer, this woman came to me and she said, you know, my husband is wearing a red sweater. Can you tell me if you see him? And the subtext was, is he alive? Tell me if he's alive. Because there were also bodies that we came across as we were walking across there. And I just thought, I feel like I'm now looking for somebody in a red sweater to see whether that person is alive. And I'm not going to be able to explain. If he's alive, it'll be fine. But if he's dead, how am I going to say it? You know, what am I going to say to her that, you know? I just felt like I couldn't really explain my country to the readers of our newspaper anymore. And I just felt I didn't have any answers, and I didn't feel like just saying that this had happened and so many people had died and that had happened and they say so-and-so is responsible. I didn't feel that that was enough anymore. So I didn't want to do it anymore. So I left. I came to study, and I did a postgraduate degree. And then I was... The BBC approached me and asked me if I would work on their African service, you know, doing the reporting on Africa and South Africa. And I said, I will stay here until an election date is announced in South Africa, and after that, I'm gone. And that's exactly what I did.
So you covered the election in South Africa then?
Yeah, I did.
It was quite an amazing time in that country.
Oh, every now and then, it's sort of one of those things that you still just think back on and just remember with such, somebody said, because I arrived with some colleagues from the BBC, I think I arrived on the elections were on the 27th, so I arrived like maybe a few days earlier. I think the elections were on a Thursday, and I arrived on the Monday morning, say. And that was the day that old people and, you know, people who couldn't make it to the ballot boxes on the day of the election were actually voting. And from that day onward until sometime in the middle of May, when Mandela was sworn in and the parliament was sworn in, I think there was a reason to cry with absolute joy and astonishment every single day in South Africa. And everybody felt it was there. Everybody. And everybody, every now and then, would just break down and sob.
When you think back to that time now, Audrey, what's the one most memorable moment from that election period? And that, I mean, I hear such a wistfulness in your voice. I wonder if you can sort of close your eyes and go back to one moment that you still take out and turn around once in a while.
When I was standing in the election booth and just composing myself to make my cross, I just remember making sure that there was nothing wrong with the ballot paper. And I went to Cliptown to vote, even though we weren't living there anymore. I went to where I had grown up and where the Freedom Charter had been signed, and this site of all these memories for the ANC and so on. So I stood in the booth, and so I'd been reporting and recording things, asking people how they felt while they were waiting in the queues, and asking people how they felt when they came out. So I was busy. But when it came to be my turn, I thought I would just, do a quick check and then put my ex on there and then say, yippee or something, and then walk out and continue working. But I just didn't. And even now, I'm still kind of quite overcome by the weight of it. Because then I remembered all these people who had died so that we could vote. And I thought about my family, and I thought about, what this meant. It was just so important. That was the thing I remember most. It was just important to do this and to do it, and to remember those who were not there to do it.
And how much, when you look back at that now, how much did Nelson Mandela have to do with making that moment possible?
I think the absolute authority that he showed when Chris Hani was assassinated earlier that year by the right wing, the white right wing in South Africa, and the fact that he basically took over as the leader of the whole country on that day, that night, when he made a broadcast and asked people not to descend into violence and anger. I think that was really the moment that you felt, the moral weight and authority that he brought to this. Because then, up to that point, the political process had been going on. What's going to happen to white South Africans? And all of this had been dragging on. And in the meantime, there was all this violence that was just racking the townships of South Africa. Besides all the other moments, all the 27 years in jail and, the sacrifices of so many other people before that, I think it was then that you felt that this is going to be a reality, because with all this other stuff going on and the newness of it all sort of rubbing off 4 years from 1990, we were in danger of just becoming mired.
You had the opportunity to travel back to Robben Island with Mandela. This would have been in, 97, is that right?
Yeah. Well, that was a sort of confluence of just the most amazing graces and blessings. I was working on a documentary about the people who had been on Robben Island and how that had affected them, and, how much they were pivotal to how South Africa turned out. So there we all were, sort of shuffling onto the ferry, getting onto the boat, sitting down, and then waiting for it to push off. And he was sort of pointing things out through the windows, telling them different things, and we were keeping a respectful distance. And then I just thought, but this is amazing. I'm going to Robben Island, and I'm my first trip to Robben Island, and I'm sitting, within touching distance of Nelson Mandela. This is amazing. It suddenly just dawned on me that this was one of those things that just, it doesn't happen in an ordinary day's work. And he was talking about his first time. He said, "Oh yeah, no, it was very, very choppy. The sea was bad, bad, bad." And says when we were so nervous, I think he was alone actually. He said, "We're really nervous, and so you've just got to keep," because we were all getting slightly seasick and queasy. And he said, "No, you've just got to keep your eye on one point. Make sure you look at one thing, and you'll be fine." And we did, and we were.
Giving advice on how to combat seasickness on the way to Robben Island.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was when Robben Island was going to be declared a World Heritage Site. So, lots of people, famous people, Quincy Jones was there on that day. I remember talking to him about it when we landed. Well, they landed later on. Yeah.
Audrey Brown is now a journalist with the BBC, and she joined me from a studio in London.
I
I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from Burt's Bees, natural health and beauty care on a mission to make people's lives better naturally for over 25 years. Burt'sBees.com. And the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org.